The Melting Pot has its own blog, which I will post a URL to on the site. But certainly, one of the directions in which people who do like radio have moved has been into internet radio. Is that something that you would consider, or is there something about terrestrial radio, as we call it, that you still like as a particularly specific medium?
I don't necessarily have anything against internet radio per se, but I really love being on the radio. A lot of what I really love about it is the kind of connection that you get to have with your audience and the kind of immediacy of it.
Right.
That people can call you up immediately and
Right.
tell you what they think of something, whether it's good or it's bad, or if they just want to talk smack to you or whatever, just like you can. Like it happens in real time with a real person on the other end. And I feel like part of the way this kind of broad media proliferation and all these different things that people can do, it kind of makes relationships people have much more intense. And I feel like you still really get that with terrestrial radio in a way that you don't quite get it online. And I certainly see that difference between, doing this blog for almost 2 years now and doing the radio show at KPFK. And it's just a very big difference in kind of sharing music one way and sharing music in the other way.
I think one of the main differences for between internet radio and terrestrial radio for me, and this has to do with the immediacy of it, is that to me, internet radio is built around convenience and the idea that you can listen to it, unless it's purely streaming, which in many ways is actually the most inconvenient way, unless you have a Wi-Fi connection in your car to be able to tune in, which doesn't seem particularly safe to find a station. But internet again, internet radio is based around convenience, and then you can listen to it when you want to. But I think the thing about the romance of old-fashioned radio to me is exactly what you're talking about, is that spontaneity and the intimacy that's created in that moment in which you're broadcasting and someone's listening to you live. And that's something that, and again, I'm not by any means critiquing internet radio, but I think one of the things that, at least at this point, it can't replicate is sort of that magic moment of being in the moment, being live. And broadcasting to that invisible audience who, if they want to, can make themselves visible by barking back on you, by calling up the station and whatnot.
Yeah, and it's especially in thinking about the kind of like that invisible audience thing, because when you do a terrestrial traditional radio show, like you never really know how many people are listening, and they're still, like these Arbitron people meters are, a little bit better than I guess the way Arbitron used to do things, but there's probably never going to be an accurate measure of the amount of people that actually listen to you. You get a slightly more accurate measure, I would imagine, from doing an internet radio program because you know how many people actually, click onto the site, how many people download the podcast or whatever. But at the same time, like it's, I don't know, kind of connected to what you were saying. Like I don't know the kind of relationships that people build up with internet radio, if they're as strong, as committed, or as deep. Yeah, I don't know. But I mean, but when you do a radio show and you do a really good show and you feel like it's a really good show, and then people tell you, "Man, that was a really good show," or you're off and you're like, "Oh,
I
why
think
did I play that?" And somebody's like, "Why the hell did you play that?" Like you know immediately,
I think the difference is, and this speaks to building that audience, is that conventional radio requires some level of routine. I mean, people usually listen, especially in Los Angeles, you listen to the radio because you're in the car or you're at home the same time every day of the week in which you can listen to your favorite show. Again, with internet radio, you can kind of choose when you want to listen to it. And again, that's great. I mean, I'm doing a podcast, obviously. I don't have a problem with the convenience aspect of it.
This is not going to be the last one.
But it's also, the thing is, I have no idea when people are listening to this, and you don't tune into a podcast in the same way that you tune into a radio show, which becomes part of your life because it necessitates, it has to be part of your life if you're going to listen to it or catch the personalities that you want to hear or the particular show that you've grown up with or have a relationship to.
Yeah, and so I mean that's the I everybody, well maybe not everybody, but there's always these obituaries being written for radio, for television in a lot of ways in the same kind of breath. And I just think that you know, a lot like vinyl,
mm-hmm.
that the connection is just different with different forms of media.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, it certainly connects. For other people, it doesn't necessarily connect. It'll be interesting, certainly, to see as, you know, as the younger generations that are around right now, who have basically only known commercial radio as it exists right now,
mm-hmm.
Who don't have that kind of sense that commercial radio really used to be very good,
mm-hmm.
Depending on where you were at. And, like, it mattered what city you were in.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what kind of relationship they then will have. I think maybe they'll have, some of them at least, more adventurous types, will continue to have very strong relationships with non-commercial radio, public radio, community radio, less so with the commercial radio stations. But yeah, you know, I mean, it, changing technology, changing times, it's always interesting to see how things shake out. But yeah, I really, to bring it all the way back to the original question, I really hope that I'm able to do traditional radio for a really long time.
Yeah.
I just really love it as a medium. And I think one of the things that happens when you do that, and I do think I did pick this up when Matthew was talking about selling his records, that it does change kind of your approach to what you buy and what you keep.
Yeah.
And it's not that it makes you appreciate the records any less. I think it actually makes you appreciate the records, the physicality of the records, in addition to the sounds of them, maybe more. Because when you're going back through and you know, like I had, you know, a couple thousand records, my collection is nowhere near that. And it would probably take me 20 years at the pace that I'm going,
mm-hmm.
to get it back up there. And so, like, when I do those rare instances where I do kind of buy vinyl now, like, I really concentrate on things that I really appreciate, that I really like. Things that I didn't have before,
yeah.
Things that I always wanted to track down. And so it definitely does kind of change your approach to, like, I had just like a much more cavalier kind of, mm-hmm. attitude to record collecting and digging in the crates, back then. But yeah, it's like a crazy thought. Like, most around that time, I was interviewing a lot of DJs for the stuff that I was doing at Berkeley. And when I would ask that question to people, I think virtually no one said that they would sell their records. It was like very rare instances. And for most people, like, it was like some kind of fanciful, complete fantasy kind of excuse for why they would have to do it, you know? But for me, it was, you know, it's just a very real world,
right,
kind of thing. And,
right,
you know, that was the only way to get it done. It's not like I really had like super, super rare things, but I mean, just some of them were just like really, like really, really solid records. Like, I know I'm not going to find like a white label copy of Booker Little's Out Front on Candid again. I'm just not going to.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing sold quick.
Mm-hmm.
That was one that kind of hurt. But that, you know, it's like, at the same time, I have a reissue of it, and I'll probably find like a Italian version or something like that of it. But yeah, I won't find that white label one again.
You're just talking about the success story of Jamaican music, and because they're on an island, you figure to build a recording studio there. I mean, it's not like they can ring some, you know, audio parts manufacturer on some other. I mean, maybe there was that industry there, but I'm assuming that a lot of the studios that were built, they had to get their parts from, you know, from the U.S. and that had to be shipped over. And, you know, things can go wrong on a boat in terms of things getting lost around the way. So there's the ability to assemble these recording studios and develop these incredible sound systems. To me, just think about the logistics of it,
yeah.
and how difficult that must have been,
yeah.
is part of what amazes me about how good the music that comes out from it. The other thought, oh, I'm sorry, you want to?
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's, I think that a lot of people, or maybe this isn't quite the right way to say it, but I don't think that people talk enough about just what great artists, all these musicians and singers and producers coming out of Jamaica because of those kind of situations. But just to have that kind of talent show through, in the midst of extraordinary poverty.
Right.
And it's like, you know, part of the reason why all those, the vinyl, you know, we, DJs are so concerned about, you know, getting our minty vinyl, and you, like, you never find minty copies of Jamaican vinyl. Well, there's a reason for that. I mean, most of it's recycled.
Yeah.
And so just that kind of nature of being able to do, trying to do whatever you can with what you got, that certainly, you know, was one of the main, you know, movers for hip hop culture as well.
Mm-hmm.
And has been, you know, one of the things that's linked together so much of electronic music, contemporary music, back to those, a lot of those ideals and ways that people got things done out of Jamaica in the 1960s and 1970s. And I just don't think, I think that's something people can't talk enough about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just an extraordinary story, and such incredible music.
The second thought I had was, when we talk about summer songs, you know, there seems to be this real synergy with Jamaican music in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And part of me wants to say, well, it's just this stereotypical idea of Jamaican music being island music in the tropics, and therefore that's the connection with summer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's got to be something more than just that, though. I don't know what it is, though, but there is this quality to, you know, a good rock steady song, a good reggae, a good dub song, which does somehow capture this notion of summer. And I don't know what it is beyond, again, our stereotypical notions of Jamaica and the tropics and island culture and all these things.
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes music is just good, just really, really good. And there are just so many great sides that come out of that period, from the mid 60s and into the 1980s, really, that are just in the pocket and just have this great quality to them. And, you know, I don't know, I'm, you know, and kind of riffing on what you were thinking of, I don't know how much of that is some kind of unconscious connection to the kind of stereotypical happy island kind of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's like when you listen to, like, old jazz records, you know, like Louis Armstrong, like hot jazz records, and those people just sound like they are having a really good time on record.
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine how good a time it was when they weren't on record.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sounds really good, even when it doesn't sound literally good.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I just think that's the quality of whatever it is. And hell, I hope we don't really figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, that they're just, I just feel like that, you know, they're just some types of music, some styles, some songs, some artists that just kind of hit you in certain ways, and it's just good.
Keep the mystery.
Maybe.
Well, this is my embarrassing melting pot admission, which is that I'd heard Boris Gardner's version first.
Yeah.
And so I assumed it was his song. And I was writing a review of the Roots album where they cover Melting Pot, and I refer to it as a cover of, you know, this reggae funk song. And it wasn't until much later I realized, oh wait, this was actually a really big hit for Booker T back in the day.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of like the Crate Digger's mentality, like flub right there, is to assign like a fairly big hit to, you know, the obscure cover version as opposed to the OG.
Which does have the break. Because the Boris Gardner version has a serious break
yes,
in it.
Yes.
And it's not completely open because there's some congas
right,
going on
right.
in it. But man, it's a serious break.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that was one of the things. It didn't, like, bring me back to the... I think by then, like, I kind of made my peace, and I was, like, past that kind of, like, purist... I don't know what you would call that kind of breakbeat, blinding, small-mindedness or whatever.
Yeah.
when I heard that, I was like, man, I wish they'd had that in the original. But at the same time, it would, like, completely wreck the flow of the original, which is just pristine. It's such a perfect song.
Yeah.